church. And the gates of hell, that is the power of the enemy, that is the authority of the enemy, will not overcome it. Peter has just made an amazing statement. They are at Caesarea Philippi, which is a place that has to be seen to be believed. There's a cave in a hillside, and out of that cave, as if from nowhere, flows the beginning of the River Jordan. And it really is quite spectacular. And Jesus has asked the question, who do people say that I am? And just like today, many different people come up with many different answers. John the Baptist, Elijah, a prophet. And then Jesus asks one of the most important questions ever asked. A question that every one of us needs to answer. And a question that gets answered in many, many different ways, just as it was then. What about you? Who do you say that I am? And Peter replied immediately before he even thought, because he was noted for that, you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Now that's the big answer. It's not the only answer. Who is Jesus? Who is he to you? Who do you say that he is? And once Peter's answer is out of the way, we can say Lord and Savior and Redeemer and Healer and so many other things. And Jesus says, on this rock, the word Peter means stone, on this rock, i.e. on this truth that Jesus is the Messiah, I will build my church. That's the way we understand this passage. Roman Catholics understand it slightly differently. They understand Peter as being the first pope, and that it's upon that rock that the church will be built. You'll know that we appointed a new pope reasonably recently. I did put my name forward. Once again, I was overlooked. I think the system is rigged. But there's some truth in that too, because the church is built on lives that are yielded to Christ. Jesus did not say Peter would build his church. Jesus didn't say that you or me would build his church. He said he would build his church. And for the last 2,000 years, against all the odds, times when it looked like there was no future for the church, times when it looked like everything would fall over, even times today when we are faced with all kinds of incredible challenges, here we are. Jesus has built his church. How many of us are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Who am I kidding? I can't count that high anyway. 11, 12, 2.5 billion. Fortunately, we're not all in this room. Across the planet, Jesus has built, is building, and will build his church. And it's worth remembering that it's not our church, it's his church. So sometimes pastors like to think that their churches are their churches. And we sometimes sort of like fall into that kind of thing in Matthew 24, where Jesus talks about bad servants who beat their fellow servants. You know, as pastors, that is one of the perks of the job. Who eat and drink at other people's expense, and we forget that it's not our church, it's Jesus' church. He's building his church, his authority, his power, and me, I get to cooperate with Jesus. And every single person here, all of us, we all get to cooperate with Jesus in building his church. So when I talk about this place and I say this is my church, it is. It's my church. My church, because I'm a part of it, not because I own it. And that means when I say this is my church, I say it in no different way from the way that you say it when you say this is my church. And again, here we are, and we're cooperating with Jesus in this place. We're doing the little jobs that are required to make a church work. We are inviting our friends. We're inviting the people that we love to come along to church. And sometimes we're inviting our enemies. Of course, you don't have to invite your enemies to church. You can send them to the church down the road. That's equally acceptable. So Jesus is building his church. And the question is, what are you building? What are you building? Luke chapter 6 and verse 46, famous story. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and don't do what I say? For everyone who comes to me and hears my words and puts them into practice, I'll show you what they're like. They're like a man who built a house, who dug down deep and laid a foundation on the rock, and when the flood came and the torrent struck, that house could not shake it. The torrent struck the house, but could not shake it. Now, make a note to get that right at the Tongan thing. It was well built. But everyone who hears my words and does not put them into practice is like a man who built a house on ground without a foundation. Now, you'll notice that's not the language you're expecting. You're expecting it to be built on sand. Built without a foundation. And the moment the torrent struck that house, it collapsed and its destruction was complete. Simple story, parable. Two people, wise and foolish, both build a house. They build houses in different locations with different foundations, two very, very different kind of houses, but from the outside looking pretty much the same. And a storm hits. The same storm hits both houses. But there are two very, very different outcomes. It's a simple parable. But you know me. I have to complicate everything. Jesus told a lot of parables, and you'll notice in a lot of his parables, there are two people. Sometimes wise and foolish. Often two brothers who represent very different approaches to life. There are always two brothers, aren't there, Inger? Life would be so much simpler if there was just one brother, wouldn't it? And wise and foolish builder. You'll recognize this from Proverbs, because Proverbs likes wise and foolish. You might have noticed that when Jesus teaches, when he stands and teaches the crowds, he doesn't teach like Moses taught the crowds. That's not his style. He doesn't preach like Isaiah preached, or like Jeremiah preached, or, thank goodness, like Ezekiel preached. Whoa, we'd be in trouble. He preaches the way that Solomon preached. He uses the techniques and the devices of what we call wisdom literature. Book of Proverbs. In fact, in Hebrew, the word for proverb is the word mishal. And it's the same word that is also translated as parable. So Jesus is a wisdom teacher. In fact, he makes that claim himself. He says, one greater than Solomon is here. And you'll know that in Proverbs, wise and foolish do not equal clever and stupid. You've heard of your IQ, right? And you know that you can do IQ tests. So Grant, if you can see that stack of papers, if you can just hand them out, and we'll do the test. Now, if you're going to do an IQ test, do it online, because it will come back and tell you you are a genius. In fact, you leave Einstein for dead. You know, it's good to do these online tests. And it's nothing to do with them trying to sell you advertising, nothing at all. IQ, how intelligent you are. The test will tell you that. Actually, what it will really tell you is how good you are at doing IQ tests. But that's not all that intelligence is. So we talk about EQ. And EQ means your emotional intelligence. How well you understand yourself and the way that you feel and the way that you behave. How well you understand others, how well you can read a situation, how well you can empathize with others. And maturity. It's life intelligence. And you'll realize that if you're employing somebody and you employ somebody who is incredibly clever but can't get along with the people they're supposed to be working with, that's not a benefit to anyone. So when you are tested for employment, they're going to want to know about your EQ as much as they're going to want to know about your IQ, because if you can't work with anybody, your intelligence isn't going to be a blessing to anybody. But beyond that, there's something called MQ. If you've never heard of it, that's because I made it up. It will be put in my next upcoming book, which will be a bestseller and will make me a multimillionaire. It's good. MQ stands for moral intelligence. And that means understanding what's right and wrong. That means the ability to live with integrity. The ability to put the fruit of the Spirit into action in your life. Moral intelligence is God's kind of righteousness. And then there's something else beyond that that you might want to call SQ, spiritual intelligence, knowing God's will, hearing His voice, the ability to know what He wants from you, the ability to love Him and to express that love to others, the ability to surrender to Him. So Jeremiah will say this. He says, if you're going to boast, don't boast about how wise you are. Don't boast about how strong you are. Don't boast about how rich you are. If you really want to boast, boast that you know who God is. Boast that you know the Lord. Boast that you understand Him. That's spiritual intelligence. And you'll realize that while Proverbs does a little bit of IQ and it does a little bit of EQ, most of what it does is MQ and even more SQ. It's about your moral intelligence and your spiritual intelligence. So the foolish builder, the wise builder, is not a clever builder. He's not a skilled builder. The wise builder is one who builds with Christ at the center. It's about moral and spiritual intelligence, who hears His voice and who obeys, who looks at the choices that have to be made in building this house and asks, what does God want? Where's His will in this? How do I honor God in this? So it's very possible that the foolish builder who is building a house next to yours might be better at building than you are. They might be more intelligent. They might be more skillful. And the house that they built might leave yours for dead until the storm comes and it collapses. Now, the other thing that shouts Proverbs here is the metaphor. Because if you look through the book of Proverbs, it will use this metaphor often. So Proverbs 24, by wisdom a house is built. Through understanding it is established. Through knowledge its rooms are filled with rare and beautiful treasure. Or chapter 14, the house of the wicked will be destroyed, but the tent of the righteous will flourish. The wise woman builds her house with her own hands. The foolish one tears hers down. I haven't got to writing that bit yet. So building a house is kind of like a key metaphor in the book. And you will realize that building the house is not about building a house. It's about building your life. The Bible likes stories. You know that, don't you? I mean, this parable is a story. It's a story about two people building houses and the outcomes. Sometimes it hides its stories. So if you look closely at the book of Proverbs, you will discover there is an untold story. And it starts in the first 9 chapters, and it starts with a young man. For the sake of argument, we will call him Inga. And he's just starting out in life. he's just, you know, coming of age, and he's beginning to figure out what he's going to do with his life, how he's going to live, who he's going to be. And there are two young ladies who have got their eye on him. And who would that be, Inga? Who would that be? I don't know. Thought maybe he just might blurt out a name. You know, the parents are sitting on the back row. Maybe they know, maybe they don't know. The two ladies that are vying for his attention are Lady Wisdom and Lady Folly, the adulteress. And both of them want to make a relationship with him. And he has to choose who he's going to marry. You get into the heart of the book, you get chapters 11 through 22, and you will discover there are 375 different proverbs. And it's like this young man has to make 375 choices. It's like he has to go through, and each time he has to make a choice whether it's going to be right or whether it's going to be left, whether it's going to be wisdom, whether it's going to be folly, whether it's going to be God or whether it's going to be self, whether it's going to be light, whether it's going to be darkness, whether he's going to pick up the bottle or whether he's going to pick up the Bible. And it's like he's faced with all these choices, and he has to make these choices in order to build his life. And then when you come to the end of the book, Proverbs 31, you get this incredible poem about, well, a woman of noble character who can find. And it goes on to describe this amazing woman and who she is and what she does. I'm going to take issue with the translation, because the word noble there is the word chayal. And everywhere else where it's used to describe a man, it will be translated as warrior. So a woman of noble character, a woman of strength, or a woman of courage, it's something along those lines. So a woman of courage who can find. Well, it turns out me. It turns out I did. I'm quite pleased with myself, really. In fact, I think she leaves the woman of Proverbs 31 for dead, but there you go. And you'll realize that the young man from the beginning of the book has made his choice. And he's chosen Lady Wisdom. But you'll also realize that Lady Wisdom has morphed from this ethereal kind of spiritual being into a real flesh and blood woman. And the guy is respected in his business world, not because of him, but because of his wife, because she is so amazing. And he's built a house. He's put God at the center. By the way, if you read that passage and you know, sort of like mark your wife and you think, well, she's probably 3 out of 10 on the woman from Proverbs 31, that means one thing. It means you're not treating her right, because it's in her and you've just got to let it out. There's another sort of a hidden thing going on here, because a couple of scholars have claimed that if you look at the numerical systems in the book of Proverbs, the numerical patterns, you can come up with the dimensions of Solomon's temple. Now, I've never quite got my head around it, but it's there in the literature. So as you're building your life, building your own house, you're also helping to build the church. You're building a temple for God. You're actually becoming living stones in your father's house. And to be honest, some of you do look like stones. I mean, you know, Vivek is wearing a grey t-shirt. You can make the mistake. Back to the parable. The builder gets a choice where to build. And the builder gets a choice how to build. And one builder starts with a foundation of rock. He has to dig down to get to that rock. And he builds directly on the rock. It's hard work. It's time consuming. It is backbreaking. You will realize from the wording of this parable, which is not the way you expect it to be, that that's not always possible. And sometimes you get to build where you can't dig down to solid rock. So what you do is you carve out from the rock one large single stone. You place that stone into the ground, and then you build your smaller stones on top of it. That long single stone is called a cornerstone. If you go to Jerusalem today, Migrash HaRusim, the Russian compound in the center of the city, you can see fenced off a cornerstone that has been half dug out. They gave up on it because it had a crack in it. And it's there now, so you can see what a cornerstone actually looked like. And this was the building technique they used. Ironically, it's exactly the same building technique we use today. Because here we are, sitting in this church, and it may alarm you to discover that this church is built on the sand. Did you know that? We're built on the sand. If you go outside and dig a hole, please don't, it will make a mess. You will dig down to sand. So what do? You lay a concrete slab and you build on top of it, and the concrete slab ensures that everything is secure. And that concrete slab is Jesus. That's what you're building on. The other builder, he's not concerned with the future. So he builds on sand, on soil without the foundation stone. It's easier. And it's quicker. And both houses look good. Until the storm comes. Now the storm itself is not hard to figure out. The storm is the day when you lose your job. It's the day when you lose your house. The day when you lose your family. It's the day when you crash your car. Or the day when you crash your finances. Or the day when you crash your reputation. The day when you lose your health. Or your wife, or your husband, or your child. We've had two funerals this week of people losing parents. These things will happen. These crises will come. The Bible describes these days as the day when the enemy comes in like a flood. These days are going to happen to every single one of us. There is no promise in this parable that you will avoid the storm or that the storm will not strike your life. There is no promise that it will not be terrifying or even do damage. The promise that's here is that if you build your house right, when the storm passes, it will still be standing. And you will have a future for another day. And the same flood, the same torrent, the same storm hits both houses, and there are two outcomes. Storms will come. We talk about a 1 in 100 year storm or a 1 in 10 year storm, but the 1 in 100 will come. And you have to build for them. So the question is, how well are you building? Because there is a storm coming. Now, Jesus did not interpret these parables for us. He left them for us to work out. Only one time does he interpret a parable. That's the parable of the sower. And that means there are different ways of reading these proverbs, these parables. And it's just possible that the storm here is something more than I've described. It's just possible that the storm here is the day of your death. And it's the day that you face judgment before God. And the question is, how have you been building? And on judgment day, will you stand? Read Psalm chapter 1. So you have to build for eternity. And the torrent struck the one house, but could not shake it. For the other house, the moment the torrent struck it, the house collapsed, and its destruction was complete. Aren't you glad that you live in Hamilton? You glad you live in Hamilton? Auckland has a problem. They love building on floodplains. Because when you build on floodplains, you're close to the water. and it's easy. And the mentality says, we can mitigate the problems. We can build in such a way that the floodwaters won't damage it. We can build culverts and drains. We've got the wisdom, we've got the knowledge, we've got the scientific understanding. And then the council forget to clear the leaves. And everybody's house floods. And it's like it's a parable for human nature. We are so convinced that we are wise enough to do our own thing without God. We are so convinced that we've reached that level of maturity as a society that we've got it sorted out and we can safely ignore God until the storm comes through. Jesus is the rock. It is not too late to build on him. How many of you live in caves? Anybody here live in a cave? Nobody lives in a cave. Anybody live in a tent? I will pray for you afterwards. We build. It's human nature to build. Human beings are builders. It's what we do. It's what we've always done. So the question is, what are you building? Now, this is going to be in a different order when the Tongans get it. But you will notice that Jesus is very specific here, because he says the difference between the two builders, both of them hear what Jesus has to say. But the wise builder puts it into practice, and the foolish builder doesn't, because Jesus had a problem. And it's the same problem that every pastor across the planet has. We can talk till we're blue in the face. We're good at it. But we can't make people listen. And more than that, we can't make them change. That's why I need to have a stick and beat people. And Jesus had exactly the same problem. He says, you call me Lord, Lord. You hear what I've got to say. You don't do it. So this isn't talking about people outside. This is talking about people inside the church. Talking about the people that actually hear. And Jesus says this frequently. Blessed are those who hear and obey. He talks about those who are ever hearing but never understanding. He talks about a seed that gets planted in the ground, but that seed gets stolen away by the enemy and never gets to grow. He says, as for a person who hears my words and does not keep them. Hearing is one thing. Doing is another. The wise person hears and puts Jesus' words into practice. The foolish person just hears. But both hear. Hearing and not doing is really dangerous. It gives us a false sense of security. We think everything is fine because, hey, we're hearing the word of God, but then the storm comes and we think hearing and doing are the same thing. They're not. And we think hearing leads to doing, and it should do, and most of the time it does, but it doesn't always. So as a foolish builder, you get to sit in the ruins of your broken house. And you look at your neighbor, the person sitting next to you in church, and you think, why is their house still standing? What is it? Does Jesus love them more than he loves me? Is that the problem? Does he not like the way that I sing? Does that person have more faith? Is it that Christianity works for them when it doesn't work for me? And you realize it's none of those things. It's just that you never took those words and put them into action. Do you have an umbrella? Yesterday I borrowed my wife's umbrella. She predicted that I would lose it. I didn't. I bought it back. Thank you. It's raining outside, so you put the umbrella under your arm, and the moment you do that means you will never get wet. Is that how it works? Carrying an umbrella prevents you from getting wet. Right. It does no such thing. You actually have to, right? And it's exactly the same with the Bible. Hearing the word isn't ever going to be enough. You've got to put it into effect. So you know that you've got to forgive those who hurt you. It's a core teaching of Jesus. Knowing it isn't enough. Understanding why it's important, how it works, isn't enough. You've actually got to do it. It's great understanding how important prayer is, but if you don't pray... In education, they talk about five different levels of knowledge, five different levels of learning. There is knowing something, and knowing something is easy, right? You can memorize it, but memorizing something isn't enough, right? You have to understand what it means, and very often we rattle off verses and we have no idea what they actually mean. You've got to understand. But beyond understanding, you've got to have aptitude. You've actually got to say, yeah, I recognize that's true. Right? What I've learned, that's true. And then you've got to have disposition. Disposition, that's something else. Disposition. And that means the decision that you're actually going to do it. Right, so I know how to repeat the Lord's Prayer. I understand what it means. I agree with it. I'm actually going to start using it. And then, lastly, you've got skill, which is the ability to do it and to do it well. So it's not just a question of putting Jesus' teachings into action. It's a question of doing it well. So Jesus says, do to others what you would want them to do to you. It's called the golden rule. And you can say it, right? You can memorize it. But you've then got to actually figure out what it means. And then you've got to make a decision that, yeah, I agree with it. And then you've actually got to start putting it into practice. And then you've got to start putting it into practice well. You get the idea? It's not enough to hear. If all you do is know, you've got to add to that understanding. To the understanding, you've got to add agreement. To the agreement, you've got to actually make the decision to do it. And then you've got to do it well. And I'm going to skip the next bit because it includes reference to me being bald, and that's controversial. It's inevitable in church that there is going to be a gap between what you know and do. I don't have a problem with that. In fact, I would have a problem if it wasn't there. So there is always going to be an element in your faith that is up here when your practice is down here. What you've got to do is increase your practice so that what you hear and what you know becomes what you do. And that's a lifelong journey because there's always more to know. Are you with me? Right. The next bit is actually going to be the heart of the sermon, and I'm going to jump over it quickly because I've only got 30 minutes and that time's now up. What are you building? Human beings are builders. And Jesus said, whoever builds, a wise builder builds a house, builds it on my teachings. But first of all, Jesus said, you build. And every single one of us are building things. The most obvious thing that you are building is a life. You are building your life. You are figuring out, just like Inga, what's good to do and what isn't good to do. You're figuring out what elements need to be a part of who you are. What your hobbies will be. What your career will be. What sport you will play. Not that shape ball. That shape ball. Nobody's biting. Certainly not that shape ball. And you're making decisions for your future, and you're building something into your life. Maybe that means building financial knowledge into your life. Maybe that means learning how to relax, because we're not very good at those things. Maybe it means learning the warning signs in your personality when you're about to lose it. I can see some of you about to lose it now. It's okay, we're almost finished. Understanding to recognize the things in your life that actually destroy rather than build. Because pride will destroy you. Right? It probably will take some other people down with you. And it's very easy to actually end up destroying the things that you're trying to build. So you're building. You're building a life. You're building a family. Your wife, your husband. Those things matter to God. Your church, your children. Those things matter to God. And you're building a family. You're building friends. You're creating a life that is multidimensional and full. And I've often said, if Judgment Day works this way, and I don't actually think it does, that God will ask me what kind of father I was before he asks me what kind of pastor I was. Hopefully he doesn't ask Connor. Hopefully he asks Sam or Azaria. You get the idea. And I'm actually building a family. And that matters. Because everything else in your life can so easily be stripped away. The car you are driving can crash. All it requires is for Sky, the International Space Station, to lose a solar panel and come straight through your roof. You can lose it all. So you build your family. The next thing you're going to build is your relationship with God. I have to remind myself on a regular basis that before I am a pastor, I am a Christian. I am a simple follower of Jesus. I am a disciple. It's very easy to read the Bible looking for your next sermon, because you've got to find one somewhere, and the Bible is probably better than the novel you're reading. But I have to read the Bible for me before I read the Bible for church. I actually have to build a personal relationship with Jesus. Because if I don't have that, nothing else that I do is going to make any sense. So I've got to do the basics. I've got to read the Bible. I've got to pray. I've got to meditate. I've got to listen to God's voice. I've got to worship. And I've got to do all of those things for me before I do them for anybody else. I'm building a relationship with God. Number four isn't written yet, so you don't get it. And just to complicate things, number five, I don't know what it is. You see, the thing is, you're you and you're different from me. And God's got different things for you than he has for me. And the things that you have to build are not the things that I have to build. But it is critical that you do build. Every single person here has passions. Every single person here has things that fascinate them and things that they're interested in. And 9 times out of 10, those things are things that God actually put in your life. Because he wants you to do something about the passion that he's placed there. So if you look at people on the street who've got nowhere to live and you walk by, that's great, that's not your passion. But if you look at them and think, oh, then you've just discovered what it is that you need to build. You've just discovered the part of your life that God wants for you. So I'm going to use the skills that God's given me. And I'm going to make sure that when Judgment Day comes, I'm not looking for a spade and desperately trying to remember where it was I hid that talent. I want to make sure that the things God gives me are used for Him. Build. Build something. Build something for God. Build something for the community around you. Build something for your family. I'm done. That's 2/3 of a sermon. You may or may not ever get to know the rest of it. Lord, I want to build something that lasts. I want to build something that gives a future for me, for my family.